From Sapporo, Japan. The Debito.org podcast for July 1st, 2010. I hope you're having a nice, warm summer, everybody. This month I have two articles for you. They're both pretty long, and they're from the community page. This is from the Japan Times, Tuesday, March 24th, 2009, and it is entitled, Punishing Foreigners, Exonerating Japanese. I see growing evidence of judicial double standards. Examine any justice system and patterns emerge. For example, consider how Japan's policing system treats non-Japanese. Zeitgeist column has discussed numerous times, as in July 8, 2008, February 20th and November 13th, 2007, May 24, 2005, January 13th, 2004, and October 7th, 2003, how police target and racially profile foreigners under anti-crime and anti-terrorism campaigns. But the bias goes beyond cops and into criminal prosecution, with Japanese courts treating suspects differently according to nationality. We've already tackled the subject of how judges discount testimony from foreigners, as in Zeitgeist column October 14, 2007, but here's the emerging pattern. If you are a Japanese committing a crime towards a non-Japanese, you tend to get off lightly. Vice versa, and you haven't a Chinaman's chance, as it were. For example, consider the Hiroshi Nozaki case. In the year 2000, Nozaki was caught flushing a Filipino woman's body parts down a public toilet. However, he was not charged with murder, only with, quote, abandoning a corpse, or shitaiki. That got him all of 3.5 years in jail. By 2008, he was stowing another dismembered Filipina corpse, that of Honie Faith Ratila Kamiosawa, in a train station locker. We've had plenty of cases where Japanese men kill and mutilate Japanese women, think of Yoshio Kodaira or Kiyoshi Okubo, and they tend to get the hangman's noose, not Nozaki. Contrast this with the case of Nigerian Osayu Amen Idubor, convicted on appeal in 2008 of sexually assaulting a Japanese woman. Sentenced to 2 years plus time served during trial, Idubor asserts that his confession was forced, that police destroyed crucial evidence, and most importantly, that there was no material evidence. It didn't matter. He got about as much jail time as Nozaki. Which means, pardon the ghoulish tone, that if Idubor had been Japanese and the woman foreign, he could have chopped her up without adding much to his sentence. If there was material evidence, that is. Is that hyperbole? Well, consider other crimes against non-Japanese women, like those of convicted serial rapist Joji Obata. His connection with the Lucy Blackman murder has been well reported, particularly the botched police investigation despite ample material evidence, even videotapes of his rapes. Regardless, in 2007, Obata was acquitted of Blackman's murder due to, quote, lack of evidence. Obata did get life imprisonment, not death, since he was only charged with, quote, rape leading to death of 9 other women, one of them foreign. But only after strenuous appeals from Blackman's family was the acquittal overturned in 2008. Obata then became guilty of, quote, dismembering and abandoning her corpse. Again, guilty of crimes to their dead bodies, not of making them dead. Now triangulate that with the case of Lindsay Ann Hawker, who was allegedly murdered by Tatsuya Ichihashi in 2007. The evidence here is damning, too. Video evidence of her accompanying him to his apartment building, her beaten and strangled body found in a tub of sand on his apartment balcony, and his fleeing barefoot when police visited to investigate. He's still at large today. You can see his mugshot on police posters, with 5 other suspects wanted for murder, or satsujin. That is, except for Ichihashi. He's just accused of, quote, abandonment of a corpse again. Last week, I called Chiba police to inquire about Ichihashi's charges. An investigator entrusted with the case wouldn't comment on specifics. Asked about the process of determining murder or abandonment, he said that if the suspect admits homicidal intent, or satsui, it's murder. However, it's unclear how at least one of the crimes shown on the poster is significantly different from Ichihashi's, or how some suspects indicated their homicidal intent before escaping. Police did not respond to requests for further clarification. Clearer is the exceptional treatment given Atsushi Watanabe, who in March 2008 choked to death an allegedly irate Scott Tucker, an American, at a Tokyo bar. Generally, in these situations, the survivor goes down for too much self-defense, or kajoboe, regardless of intent. That precedent was set in the 1980s by Steve Bellamy, a British martial artist who intervened in a drunken altercation and killed someone. Bellamy was acquitted of wrongdoing, then convicted on appeal, and then acquitted again. Although asphyxiating somebody is arguably overdoing it, media anticipated the case was, quote, likely to draw leniency. They were right. Last November, Tucker's killer got a suspended sentence of 3 years. Moreover, public prosecutors, normally pit bulls in these situations, decided not to appeal. Even less tenacious were the police prosecuting Peter Barrakhan's case. Barrakhan, a famous British commentator on Japanese TV, was assaulted with pepper spray by a masked assailant in 2007. Police tracked down the getaway van, found the driver, and found mace cans in the back. Yet no one was given that 23-day maximum marathon of interrogations granted for investigating lesser crimes, such as foreigners who don't cooperate with police ID checks. Barrakhan tells me the police have since done, quote, absolutely zilch about his case. Maybe police were too busy to pursue Barrakhan's macing, but I doubt the relatives of American Matthew Lacey would sympathize. As the Japan Times reported in 2007, Lacey was found dead in his apartment in a pool of blood in 2004. Fukuoka police declared the cause of death to be, quote, dehydration. When his family insisted on an autopsy, the cause was updated to, quote, cerebral hemorrhage, apparently from an accidental fall. The police, however, refused to issue Lacey's full autopsy for independent investigation. Public prosecutors and the U.S. Embassy have not pursued the case. It's a busy world. So does this mean that authorities have it in for foreigners? You could make that case. This is a land with a policing regime instead of an immigration policy, where under the Foreign Registry Law, Article 18, only foreigners can be arrested, fined up to 200,000 yen, and incarcerated for up to a year just for not carrying identification 24/7. Severe criminal penalties for something as easy to misplace as a library card or car keys? You could argue that this system affects everyone, regardless of nationality. Masayuki Suo's excellent movie, I Just Didn't Do It, depicts how the judicial process overwhelmingly favors the prosecution. Don't forget that 99.9% conviction rate. But you'd be wrong. Non-Japanese are particularly disadvantaged because, one, there is no certified quality control for court and investigative language interpretation. Two, public prosecutors can have negative attitudes towards non-Japanese. And three, non-Japanese cannot get bail, or hoshaku. Item 1, quality control of translations, creates obvious communication problems for non-natives, especially given how heavily Japan's judiciary relies on confessions. So let's not dwell further. The next item, attitudes of prosecutors, has received due attention from scholars. For example, Professor David T. Johnson writes in his book, The Japanese Way of Justice, that prosecutors consider, quote, crimes committed by foreigners as one of the three main challenges facing the bureaucracy. Tokyo University professor Daniel H. Foote was cited saying that criminal justice officials have, quote, stepped up their surveillance and prosecution of foreign workers, end quote, and that the foreign influx poses, quote, the greatest external challenge, end quote, to Japan's benevolent paternalism in criminal justice. Thus, foreigners, in Foote's view, have, quote, a separate track for criminal prosecution. As for bail, it may be difficult for Japanese to get, but it's impossible for non-Japanese to get. Standard reasons for denial are fears that the suspect might flee or destroy evidence. However, that didn't stop twice convicted yet bailed businessman Takafumi Horie or Diet member Suzuki Munio, who even got re-elected during his perpetual appeal. Non-Japanese, however, face an extra legal layer, status of residence. Stuck in Japanese jug means you can't renew your visa at immigration. Therefore, the logic goes, if a foreigner is bailed, even if they don't flee, they might get deported before their trial is finished. So, they remain in custody for the duration of the case, no matter how many years it takes. Then, they can be released for deportation. And it will indeed take years. For example, a Swiss woman declared innocent twice in court of drug smuggling has been incarcerated since October 2006. Even though an acquitted Japanese would have been released during the appeal, the Supreme Court upheld the denial of her bail. Same with Nepalese man Govinda Prasad Mainali, acquitted of murder in 2000, yet detained until his conviction in high court that same year. Thus, for foreign defendants, all a public prosecutor has to do is file an appeal, and it will avoid any court acquittal. So let's summarize. If you're a foreigner facing Japan's criminal justice system, you can be questioned without probable cause on the street by police, apprehended for quote-unquote voluntary questioning in a foreign language, incarcerated perpetually while in litigation, and treated differently in jurisprudence than a Japanese. Statistics bear this out. According to Johnson, 10% of all trials in Japan had foreign defendants in 2000, considering that non-Japanese residents back then were 1.3% of the Japanese population, and foreign crime, depending on how you calculate it, ranged between 1 and 4% of the total, you have a disproportionate number of foreigners behind bars in Japan. Feeling paranoid? Don't. Just don't believe the bromide that Japanese are a peaceful, law-abiding people by nature. They're actually scared stiff of the police and the public prosecutor. So should you be. For until official government policy changes to make Japan even more receptive to immigration, non-Japanese will be treated as a social problem and policed as such. And here's my next column, the Japan Times, Tuesday, April 7th, 2009. It's another long one entitled, Golden Parachutes Mark Failure of Race-Based Policy. Japan's employment situation has gotten pretty dire, especially for non-Japanese workers. The Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare reports that between last November and January, more than 9,000 foreigners asked the Hello Work Unemployment Agency for assistance. That's 11 times the figure for the same period a year earlier. That ministry also claims that non-Japanese don't know Japan's language and corporate culture, concluding that they're largely unemployable. So select regions are offering information centers, language training, and some degree of job placement. Good. But, read the small print. Not only does this plan only target 5,000 people, but the government is also trying to physically remove the only people they can from unemployment rosters, the foreigners. Under an emergency measure drawn up by the Liberal Democratic Party only last month, from April 1st, the Japanese government is offering Nikkei, i.e. workers of Japanese descent on long-term resident visas, a repatriation bribe. Applicants get 300,000 yen plus 200,000 yen for each family dependent if they, quote, return to their own country, and bonuses if they go back sooner. History is repeating itself, in a sense. Those Nikkei beneficiaries are the descendants of beneficiaries of another of Japan's schemes to export its unemployed. A century ago, Japan sent farmers to Brazil, America, Canada, Peru, and other South American countries. Over the past two decades, however, Japan has brought Nikkei back under yet another wheeze to utilize their cheap labor. This time, however, if they take the ticket back home, they can't return, at least not under the same preferential work visa. Let this scheme sink in for a minute. We now have close to 500,000 Nikkei living here, some of whom have been here for up to 20 years, paying in their taxes and Social Security. They worked long hours at low wages to keep our factories competitive in the world economy. Although these policies have doubled Japan's foreign population since 1990, few foreigners have been assimilated. Now that markets have soured, foreigners are the first to be laid off, and their unassimilated status has made them unmarketable in the government's eyes. So now, policy has become, train 1%, as in that 5,000, to stay, bribe the rest to be gone, and become some other country's problem. Sound a bit odd? Now consider this. This scheme only applies to Nikkei, not to the other non-Japanese workers also here at Japan's invitation. Thus, it's the ultimate failure of a returnee visa regime founded upon racist paradigms. How did all of this come to pass? It's time for a little background. Japan had a huge labor shortage in its blue-collar industries in the late 1980s, and realized with the rise in the value of the yen and high minimum wages that Japan's exports were being priced out of world markets. Japan's solution, like that of other developed countries, was to import cheaper foreign labor. However, as a new documentary entitled Sour Strawberries, Japan's Hidden Guest Workers, reveals, Japan's policy was fundamentally different. Elites worried about debasing Japan's supposedly homogeneous society with foreigners who might stay. So the official stance remained, no immigration, and no import of unskilled labor. But that was all tatemae, a facade. Urged by business lobbies such as the Japan Business Federation, or Nippon Keiranren, Japan created a visa culture from 1990 to import foreign laborers, mostly Chinese, as quote-unquote trainees, ostensibly to learn a skill, but basically to put them in factories and farms, doing unskilled, dirty, difficult, and dangerous labor eschewed by Japanese. More importantly, trainees were getting paid less than half minimum wage, as they were not legally workers under labor law, and receiving no social welfare. Even the offer of competitive wages was tatemae. Although some trainees were reportedly working 10 to 15 hours a day, one media outlet mentioned 22-hour days, 6 to 7 days a week including holidays, they found themselves receiving sums so paltry they beggared belief. Think 40,000 yen a month, yes, 4 man. A Chinese trainee interviewed in Sour Strawberries said he wound up earning the same as he would in China. Others received even less, being charged by employers for rent, utilities, and food on top of that. Abuses proliferated. Trainees were harassed and beaten, found their passports confiscated and pay withheld. And they were even fired without compensation if they were injured on the job. One employer hired thugs to force his Chinese staff to board a plane home. But trainees couldn't just give up and go back. Many had received travel loans to come here, and if they returned early, they would be in default, sued by their banks and ruined. Thus, they were locked into abusive jobs they could neither complain about nor quit without losing their visa and livelihoods overseas. As labor union leader Torii Ippei explains in Sour Strawberries, this government-sponsored but largely unregulated trainee program made so many employers turn bad that places without worker abuses were, quote, very rare. But trainees weren't the only ones being exploited. 1990 was also the year the long-term resident visa was introduced for the Nikkei. However, unlike the trainees, they were given labor law protections and unlimited employment opportunities, supposedly to allow them to explore their heritage, while being worked 10 to 15 hours a day, 6 days a week. Why this most favored visa status for the Nikkei? Well, the elites, in their ever-unchallenged wisdom, figured Nikkei would present fewer assimilation problems. After all, They have Japanese blood, ergo the prerequisite understanding of Japan's unique culture and garbage sorting procedures. So, as the LDP and Keidanren policymakers testified in Sour Strawberries, it was deemed unnecessary to create any integration policy, or even to make them feel like they belong in Japan. It was completely counterproductive and demoralizing for an enthusiastic workforce. A Nikkei interviewed in the film mentioned how overseas she felt like a Japanese, yet in Japan, she ultimately felt like a foreigner. So over the past 20 years, Japan has invited over 1 million non-Japanese to come here and work. And work they did, many in virtual indentured servitude. Yet instead of being praised for all their contributions, they became scapegoats. They engendered official opprobrium for alleged rises in crime and overstaying, even though per capita crime rates were higher among Japanese than foreigners, and the number of visa overstayers has dropped every year since 1993. They were also bashed for not learning the language, when they actually had little time to study, let alone attend Japanese classes offered by a handful of merciful local governments. Nothing but disincentives towards settling in Japan. The policy was doomed to failure. And fail it did on April Fool's Day this year, when the government confirmed that Nikkei didn't actually belong here and offered them golden parachutes. Of course, it was a race-based benefit, unavailable to wrong-blooded trainees who have to make it home on their own dime, perhaps with some fines added on for overstaying, to face financial ruin. It's epiphany time. Japan's policymakers haven't evolved beyond an early Industrial Revolution mindset, which sees people, well, foreigners anyway, as mere work units. Come here, work your ass off, and then go home when we have no more use for you. It's the way we've dealt many times before with foreigners, and the way we'll probably deal with those Indonesian and Filipino care workers for scheming to come take care of our elderly. Someday, potential immigrants will realize that our government is just using people. But the way things are going, we eventually won't be rich enough for them to overlook that. What should be done instead? Japan must take responsibility. You invited foreigners over here, now treat them like human beings. Give them all the same labor rights and job training that you'd give every worker in Japan, and free nationwide Japanese lessons to bring them up to speed. Reward them for their investment in our society and their taxes paid. Do what you can to make them more comfortable and settled. And stop bashing them. Let Japanese society know why foreigners are here and what good they've done for our country. You owe them that much for the best part of their lives they've given you. Don't treat foreigners like toxic waste, sending them overseas for somebody else to deal with. And don't detoxify our society under the same race-based paradigms that got us into this situation in the first place. You brought this upon yourselves through a labor policy that ignored immigration and assimilation. Now deal with it, here, in Japan, by helping non-Japanese residents of whatever background make Japan their home. That's not a radical proposal. Given our low birth rate, aging society demographics, experts have been urging you to do this for a decade now. This labor downturn won't last forever, and when things pick up again, you'll have a younger, more acculturated, more acclimatized, even grateful workforce to help pick up the pieces. Just sending people back, where they will tell others about their dreadful years in Japan being exploited and excluded, is on so many levels the wrong thing to do. All right, and that will finish up this podcast. And as always, I'd like to conclude with the Duran Duran track. This is a lovely little song that I really like called Breath After Breath. the Davy Tittle Dog Podcast for July 1st, 2010. Thank you, everybody, for listening, and have a nice summer.